You are listening to a sermon by Henry Neufeld, recorded on Sunday, July 5th, 2009, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
In the Fraser Valley community where I grew up, there was one family where everybody in the family attended our church except for the father. The mother and two daughters attended regularly. They participated in most church activities. It seemed odd to me at the time that Mr. Weeb did not attend church. But as a youngster, I was never aware of the reason for this. I didn't ask anyone, and I never heard it discussed. It was just an accepted fact. Mr. Weeb did not come to church. A few years ago, I spoke with an older man from that community. There are some people from that community older than me. And I asked him why Mr. Weeb, now long deceased, did not attend church. Well, the explanation I got was that Mr. Weeb listened to a lot of radio preachers. And he developed some ideas about faith that were not consistent with the church leaders' thinking at the time. So the church leaders apparently met with him and tried to dissuade him from his thinking. Whatever it was, I never did find out. But he wouldn't budge. So I don't know if he was angry at one or all of the lay ministers in our church, or if he was frustrated with the church's general teaching. Regardless, he simply refused to attend our church, or any church. He stayed home on Sundays and presumably continued to listen to radio preachers. Well, I thought of him when I read this opening chapter of this letter to Timothy, because a central thrust in this letter is the desire to root out false teaching. And I wonder, but I don't know, whether Mr. Weeb was guilty of some false teaching or some false ideas. Now, the writer to Timothy defines false teachings as whatever is contrary to healthy teachings. And that doesn't help very much. It's like saying food not good for you is food that is unhealthy. I would have preferred a little more specificity in the text, but it's not there. Now, the author of this letter is questionable. Most theologians do not think Paul wrote it. In the commentary that we have written by Ray Bystrom, he mentions this and mentions that some people think Paul did write it. And he also suggests that possibly Paul had a secretary, a scribe, to whom he dictated. And I find that explanation somewhat plausible, because the scribe may have written down what Paul said and then added a bunch of things which he thought would help clarify a few things for these stupid people in Ephesus. But we really don't know. So sometimes I'm going to refer to the letter writer as Paul and sometimes not, and you can make your own judgment on that. But at the beginning of the letter, he describes his connections to Timothy. He's a young worker, and he's a son, a true son in the faith. And those words sound like a stamp of approval from a bishop or some person in authority in the church. And the writer also establishes his own authority. He says he is writing by the command of God. Now, I find that a rather powerful and arrogant statement, to be writing at the command of God. It's like someone saying, well, God told me this, and God told me to do this. And I assume that the writer wanted to assert his authority, since this letter was probably going to be read to the Christians in Ephesus. Well, in a church with a lot of new Christians, there might be new believers who were inclined to accept some new ideas or new doctrines uncritically. And some were teaching false doctrines. Now, Paul, or the writer, doesn't tell us how he heard about these false doctrines. Presumably, Timothy wrote and said something to the effect that he had these guys in his church who were preaching this stuff, and what should he do with them? And it really would be great if we had had a copy of Timothy's letter to Paul saying, here's the problems I've got. So we don't know exactly what these false teachings were. Three things are mentioned: godless myths, old wives' tales, and endless genealogies. Now, presumably, the genealogy reference is not a criticism of a historical society. Rather, it's a reference to the practice of tracing one's ancestry back to Adam and Eve. Now, it's sort of surprising to find this in here, because when this letter was written, I don't think the Gospel of Matthew had been written yet. Because Matthew begins with a genealogy, a long one and a very detailed one, from Abraham right through to the birth of Jesus. So here we have Timothy saying, talking about endless genealogies, and Matthew, you know, providing us with a good genealogy. Peterson's translation doesn't mention endless genealogies, but talks about people introducing fantasy stories and fanciful family trees that digress into silliness. Now, one translation says that these false teachers have gone astray into a wilderness of words. And getting lost in a wilderness of words is quite a comment. And I hope I can avoid that this morning. In 2 Timothy, there's some elaboration on the false teachings. And there we're told that the false teachings relate to the resurrection, with some people teaching that the resurrection of believers has already happened. And this could be what the writer was concerned about. However, at the end of this list of complaints about the false teachers, we have a beautiful catch-all phrase: whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine. And that sort of covers the waterfront. I like Peterson's summary. The whole point of what we're urging is simply love. Love that is uncontaminated by self-interest and counterfeit faith. A life open to God. Now that's a powerful line. The whole point of this is love. Love uncontaminated by self-interest. And I find this surprising, because the writer tells Timothy to command these false teachers to stop, and then at the very end of the chapter says he's turning his false teachers over to Satan so they can be taught a lesson or two about not blaspheming. Turning them over to Satan does not sound like an act of love. Now, Paul then goes on to present himself as a model for Timothy, for church leaders, and all believers to follow. Where false teachers will emphasize the law, Paul stresses grace and mercy. And interesting, Paul does not hang on to his academic credentials, and he had lots. Rather, he expresses amazement that God would consider him an anti-Christian fanatic and a persecutor of Christians as worthy for God's work. And Paul is surprised that God would consider him for the ministry. And Paul says, I was granted mercy because I was ignorant and unbelieving. So Paul has a powerful sense of his own sinfulness and his helplessness before God. I am the worst of them, he says. And I'm surprised that Paul still talks in the present tense. I am the worst of sinners, rather than saying, I was the worst of sinners. And Paul also points out that the law has some benefits, but that the law is really for people who live irresponsibly, for people who tend to defy authority. The final goal, says Paul, is love. Love that comes from a pure heart, a clear conscience, and a sincere faith. A love that is uncontaminated by self-interest. Well, this chapter raises some interesting questions and problems for me. How do we identify false teachings? How can churches stick to important issues and avoid dialogue about minor issues? The Bible has stories of false teachings, beginning with the idols of the Old Testament and other false gods. The early church had a major problem with the false teaching of allowing Gentiles into the church. And Paul's letters are almost all corrective letters. They're corrective of some false teaching in the church, or some error in the church. Martin Luther and some early Anabaptists were persecuted for false teachings. Today we say they weren't false, but they were accurate and well ahead of their time. So how do we differentiate between false teachers and prophets? Should Mr. Weeb in my home community have been told to cease and desist? I wonder how that situation could have been handled differently. We often focus on creeds, on statements of faith, and mission statements and covenants, thinking that if we just agree on everything, things will be fine. Or, to root out false teachings, we get the senior church bureaucrats, conference ministers, to come in and straighten out the wayward thinkers. So, we probably need to distinguish between new insights, prophetic notions, and false teachings. And when it comes to doctrinal disagreements, there are no easy solutions. Maybe we can simply say that sound teaching conforms to the message of Jesus. It propels us to serve others. Jesus had other wise words about identifying false teachers. He had a simple solution. He said, "By their fruits you shall know them." Look at the fruit. Look at the behavior. Look at the product. These two former leaders in the Ephesian church wandered from the faith. Paul says he has handed them over to Satan so they can learn not to be blasphemous. And I found this astounding for two reasons. First, that Paul would say he handed them over to Satan, whatever that means. And then he says that they will learn from Satan not to be blasphemous. And this really puzzles me. I just don't know what to make of that. So, I asked my brother, who knows more about these things than I do, and he said there was a similar passage in Corinthians that he had come across recently where Paul turned somebody over to Satan. And so my brother was surprised at this too. And he said he had written two prominent theologians to ask for interpretations of this because he doesn't understand it. My brother's theory was that Paul lapsed into an unchristian moment. For me, the key to this chapter are the words, "The whole point of this is love, a love that is not contaminated by self-interest." And that's a very powerful line, love not contaminated by self-interest. We help someone and we reap no benefit from it. Or we provide assistance to someone anonymously. That's the kind of love Paul is talking about. And he's echoing Jesus' words about people who do their good deeds so that others see it. And Jesus said, they've already got their reward. They were seen by others, and that's their reward. The whole point, Paul says, is love. Love uncontaminated by self-interest. And a love that frees us from self-interest. The other thing about this chapter that is perplexing and it makes me wonder about who wrote it is the editing, because the doxology sort of appears three quarters of the way through the chapter. Well, a doxology normally appears at the end of a book, and we have one here right in the middle of the chapter, and I want to close with it. "Now to the God eternal, immortal, invisible, the only God, be honor and glory forever and ever. Amen."